Hearts and Minds. Saeed Purizab, London.
He is referred to as the head of ambassadors in Iran. Salah al-Zawawi has retired after completing his 40th year as the Palestinian ambassador to Iran. He finished his tenure in January when he was succeeded by his daughter, Salam al-Zawawi. Here at the Tehran office of the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the former Palestinian envoy was honored for his 4 decades of activities. Following the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution, Iran ended its alliance with Israel and officially recognized Palestine as a state. This was followed by shutting down the Israeli embassy in Tehran and turning it over to the Palestinian Liberation Organization. Al-Zawawi was among a delegation headed by then PLO chief Yasser Arafat, who came to Iran days after the revolution and symbolically took over the keys of the embassy. Al-Zawawi is one of the founding members of Fatah political party and the second Palestinian ambassador to Iran since the 1979 Islamic Revolution. He has held the post since 1981, and before that, he served as the Palestinian ambassador to Algeria, Brazil, and Kenya. Throughout his career, Al-Zawawi took major steps to shed light on the Israeli occupation of Palestine, which has been ongoing for more than 7 decades.
After 4 decades of serving as Palestine's envoy to Iran, Salah al-Zawawi is now retiring. But unlike any other ambassador, he's not going to live his retired life in his home country, as he's one of the millions of Palestinian diaspora who are denied the right to return to their homeland. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
If passed, the Borders and Nationality Bill will give the UK government the power to jail asylum seekers for up to 4 years if they arrive via sea routes like the English Channel, and others could be sent to a third country for processing and detention. The devolved nations Scotland and Wales have already rejected it as an anti-refugee bill, and people on the streets of London are demanding Westminster do the same.
They're putting legislation in protest in place so that they can put guns on our beaches. That's what they want to do, because the migrants that will be coming when the climate and the ecological emergency really begins to hit, we want to welcome and they want to keep out.
Britain's banks, its military, its companies, companies across the world creating poverty, creating destruction and warfare, and when people try to flee from the consequences of that, Britain puts up fences, borders, guards to keep people out.
The bill also gives the government extraordinary powers when it comes to ethnic minorities in the UK. A proposed rule change quietly added to the bill will give the Home Secretary draconian powers over immigrants, first, second and third generation alike.
The fact of the matter is you can be born and bred legally in the UK, but if you have dual citizenship or can claim citizenship somewhere else, the British government might give itself permission to strip you of your British citizenship. In short, you're not British enough. You're a second-class citizen.
Once you are a citizen, you have the right to remain a citizen. I mean, there's many incidents. That young woman in Syria, that's such an important precedent. They groomed her. She should be brought home. She should be looked after. This is, in any other situation, this would be considered child abuse.
Shamima Begum was 15 years old when she left the UK for Syria, where she was absorbed by the Daesh terrorist group. As a second-generation Bangladeshi, she has been stripped of her citizenship and is still languishing in a Syrian refugee camp.
These are the most racist pieces of legislation we've seen in the UK in modern British history. They constitute a direct infringement on every minority's rights, giving the right for a politician to take away our citizenship and giving the government overwhelming power to decide immigration policy. We're resisting today, we'll resist tomorrow, and we invite the country to resist alongside us.
Under the new bill, the government would no longer have to inform someone they are about to lose their citizenship. This will make appealing the decision almost impossible. Rights groups say these measures are used mainly against British Muslims, but Black and Asian Britons also say they now live in fear. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Sunday, the 27th of February, has been described as a major turning point for the EU. Including fighter jets, the 27-country bloc is going to send deadly military hardware to Ukraine, which will be used against Russian forces.
For the first time ever, the European Union will finance the purchase and delivery of weapons and other equipment to a country that is under attack.
The EU has always labelled itself as a peace project. Analysts are now questioning this.
They release huge funds to buy these lethal weapons from their own industries and to supply belligerent groups to continue the conflict. I think it's absolutely shocking and it's funeral of the European project as such, because it's not more a project of peace.
Another package of sanctions against Russia and Belarus were agreed by EU foreign affairs ministers on Sunday. Some Russian banks are being blocked from the SWIFT financial payment system.
This degree of disconnection is carefully calibrated in order to create the maximum damage to the financial system of Russia.
EU airspace is being closed to all Russian aircraft, and Russian media outlets, including RT, are being banned from broadcasting in the 27-nation bloc. Also on Sunday, EU Home Affairs ministers met to discuss support for member states Poland, Slovakia, Hungary and Romania, which have witnessed flows of asylum seekers.
We have already seen more than 300,000 Ukrainians are fleeing the country, coming to the European Union.
Meanwhile, all eyes are now on the Kremlin to see how it might respond to this latest set of measures. The EU is clearly taking a calculated risk by providing deadly weapons to Ukraine. But could this lead to the crisis spiralling completely out of control? EU citizens will be hoping the risk has not been miscalculated by the bloc. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
After months of suspension, Afghan public universities have reopened. We visited Kabul University and spoke with a number of teachers and students. They say they're happy returning to the campus and hope good educational days are ahead.
We are very happy that we have returned to university again. We have been away from our classes and lessons for almost 7 months. I was longing for this day so much. This new beginning and opportunity can motivate us and give more hope for the future.
It is a big day for the young generation. The opening of the doors of universities could open the doors of developments. I hope this process continues well. I urge the international community to help our higher education sector and poor families so that their sons and daughters can get education.
Male and female students are returning to Kabul University, but in different shifts. Moreover, new roles and changes are brought by the new directors.
Actually, I witnessed a lot of changes in Kabul University. First, some departments in the fine art faculty like cinema, music, and theater are said to be cancelled. Secondly, students are obliged to change their outfits. Girls should come in the morning and boys in the afternoon. In addition, we didn't find most of our former teachers and there were new figures.
Some experts say it's not all about reopening, and there are many challenges left on the way of higher education in Afghanistan.
A huge number of our scholars, professors, and lecturers left our country during the government change. This has caused a significant loss in our higher education institutions. We need them back now. Furthermore, the Taliban government are going to make changes in universities' educational syllabuses and staff. It's uncertain where the Taliban are leading our higher education.
Like most public universities, Kabul University had closed in the immediate aftermath of the Taliban takeover. Formerly, the university had remained shut for some months due to COVID-19 pandemic. The reopening of universities have brought hope to the younger generation in Afghanistan. The students here say this process must be supported in advance so that they can continue their education this year successfully. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of a speech delivered on February 17, 2022 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution via video conference with the participation of people from Tabriz and East Azerbaijan, commemorating the anniversary of the Tabriz uprising of February 18, 1978.
In other words, in the few centuries that I have mentioned, this flag has never stopped being hoisted by the people of Azerbaijan. It is the same in many other cities, but Azerbaijan has a special role in this issue. This is also one of the great honors of Azerbaijan. So, the February 18th Tabriz Uprising movement helped the fight to continue. Today, I wish to raise a few points about this continuation. Continuation is the key to the victory of every movement. If a movement fails to continue and to take the subsequent steps after the initial one, it will become sterile, fruitless, and ineffectual. We know certain movements and revolutions in the world which had a good start and which took important steps, but they did not achieve victory because the members of the movement, be that the leaders or the followers and the masses of the people who followed their leaders, were discouraged from continuing the path. They became tired, disappointed, or they buried themselves with material trifles. They became hopeless or afraid and they suffered from domestic conflicts. For whatever reason, they failed to take the next steps. Consequently, the movement failed to achieve victory. That is why I say that the continuation of a movement is the key to its victory.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The February 18th Tabriz Uprising laid the foundation for the continuation of the people's ground activities. The people of Tabriz did something that started the people's ground movement. Well, the fight began years before that. There were all kinds of fighting in different parts of the country, but the presence of the people started from Qom. And if it were not for the Tabriz incident, the issue of Qom would have been forgotten. The people of Tabriz taught continuity to everyone. And the 29th of Bahman was beginning of the continuation of the great movement that had begun. This initiative encouraged the people to show their presence in the arena, and it made the loud cry of Imam, may God bestow paradise on him, to be heard louder than ever by all the people of Iran.
Allah, I want to thank you. Things that you've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah,
in the limelight.
Though the impact is already being felt, heat waves are largely silent killers. Often, the toll is tallied far into the aftermath of an event and is vastly undercounted. Unlike wildfires and floods that produce immediate and visible destruction, heat waves' harmful effects can seem more subtle, even if they're in fact more deadly. Here we present you an article written by Gabrielle Cannon. The piece is titled California Debates Naming Heat Waves to Underscore Deadly Risk of Extreme Heat. Climate scientists from around the world issued dire warnings recently in the latest IPCC report on the dangers posed in the unfolding climate crisis. Among them is extreme heat, a crisis that on average already claims more American lives than hurricanes and tornadoes combined. Though the impact is already being felt, heat waves are largely silent killers. Often the toll is tallied far into the aftermath of an event, and is vastly undercounted. Unlike wildfires and floods that produce immediate and visible destruction, heat waves' harmful effects can seem more subtle, even if they're in fact more deadly. Chrissy Ebbey, a professor in the Center for Health and the Global Environment at the University of Washington, says, "People don't think of heat as a hazard, but in the Pacific Northwest, where Ebbey lives, for example, unprecedented temperatures baked the region last year, bewildering residents used to moderate, often lukewarm summers. Policymakers and environmentalists are looking for better ways to close the gap in the public's perception of the risks of heat waves, especially in the American West, where landscapes are rapidly warming. Some are pushing for new ranking systems to help elevate awareness around the issue, or assign heat waves names, much like federal agencies do for hurricanes." Kathy Bogman-McLeod, the Senior Vice President and Director of the Adrienne Ash Rockefeller Foundation Resilience Center, said, "We need a shock to the system. The organization, which focuses on policy solutions to the climate crisis, has advocated heat wave naming along with number categories as a way to add urgency to the growing disasters." She says, "If you go into the hospital now and are suffering from heat, they will say you have kidney failure or heart failure." She added, "There are so many areas now we need to culturally shift that context of heat." Group advised California on new legislation introduced last year, which would make it the first state to implement a naming and ranking system, like the organizational system for categorizing storms dating back in the 1800s. Athens, Greece, and Seville, Spain will roll out similar programs later on this year. Advocates of the program believe assigning a name to a disaster will help people engage with it. Kathy Bogman-McLeod said, "It becomes an identity and a brand is built," adding that it also helps for archival purposes. McLeod noted, "We all remember what happened during Hurricane Sandy. I know what a Category 3 is, and I know when it has a name, it has reached a certain threshold, and I need to pay attention and act. Still, the science isn't clear on whether a name would do much to communicate heightened dangers in the most effective way." Kimberly McMahon, a National Weather Service Public Weather Services program manager, said, "The National Weather Service is not aware of any research or evidence that suggests naming heat waves would raise awareness about heat-related risks." But she said early warning systems, with or without associated names, play an important part, adding, Even knowing the potential for a heat event or abnormally hot summer can allow preparations to occur further in advance. Naming aside, the two bills in California also outlined the creation of an interagency heat task force, an extreme heat advisory council, and will open a new chief heat officer role to oversee planning and preparation. The pieces of legislation, if they pass, would initiate statewide advance warning and ranking by the start of 2024 and would establish the Extreme Heat and Community Resilience Program to coordinate state efforts and coordinate with local and regional officials. Chrissy Ebbey, a professor in the Center for Health and the Global Environment at the University of Washington, says that coordination between agencies that include local, state and federal programs will be key. Noting that a variety of stakeholders should be brought to the table, Chrissy Ebbey says, there are lots of opportunities to facilitate the information transfer so that as people develop these systems, they don't start from the very beginning. She added, on the one hand, the projections are dire, but on the other, we have an enormous basket of options for what can be done to protect people who are at higher risk during a heat wave. Several municipalities across Western United States and governments across the globe are already adopting heat programs and heat plans. At the federal level, the National Integrated Heat Health Information Systems and White House Extreme Heat Intra-Agency Working Group are collaborating to expand messaging about extreme heat and offering up lessons learned. Phoenix, which is at the top of the list of rapidly heating cities, hired scientist and the heat expert David Hondula to head its new Office of Heat Response and Mitigation in September of last year, becoming the first U.S. city to launch a publicly funded position of this kind. Miami, Florida also brought on a chief heat officer, as did Athens, Greece, and Freetown in Sierra Leone. There's still a difficult path ahead, but according to Kirsty Ebbey, planning will go a long way. She said, all heat-related deaths are preventable. We have a real opportunity to improve lives today, even if the climate continues to change. Meanwhile, Southern California, home to 23 million people, has largely been spared the kind of extreme fire escalation experienced in the northern part of the state. But models drawn up by researchers at the University of California at Los Angeles have predicted that will change. Wildfires in Southern California are often driven by dry winds, low humidity, and high temperatures. And the climate crisis is creating the perfect conditions for them to burn hotter, faster, and more frequently. Analyzing data from 49 climate stations scattered across the southern coast, from Santa Barbara to San Diego, the University of California at Los Angeles study found that the region could see double the number of what scientists call large fire days by 2100 if greenhouse gas emissions are not curbed. Even in a more moderate scenario, where heating is slowed, the researchers' models showed a 60% increase in high-risk days compared with the late 20th century. Glenn MacDonald, a professor of geography at the University of California at Los Angeles and the lead author of the study, said, things are going to get worse. The researchers analyzed a series of variables that can increase fire risk and found certain climatic characteristics, especially how dry the air is, usually determine when the biggest blazes erupt. MacDonald said, from what we found, that you could sort of predict when you were going to have your large fire probability in Southern California. After determining the patterns most associated with wildfires, Researchers modelled how those patterns might change in the decades ahead. They found that not only will days get drier, but those days will start to show up earlier in the spring and stick around later into the autumn, thus extending the probability to a greater part of the year. They found these high-risk days would probably increase from the 36 days a year documented from the 1970s to the late 1990s to 71 days a year by 2070. These conditions won't just produce more wildfires, they will also affect fire behavior, making them more destructive and harder to contain. Southern California's landscapes, which are dominated by grassland and shrubland rather than large forests, burn and recover differently from their northern neighbors. Decades of poor land management and tamping down on indigenous practices of prescribed burnings has also left Northern California's forests overcrowded and primed for bad burns, an issue that's less prevalent in Southern California. McDonald says that's partly why the region have had such different experiences with wildfires. It's not like climatologically we have been dodging the bullet, but we just haven't seen the same impact that we see in the more remote regions of Northern California and the Sierra Nevada in those forested systems. That doesn't mean the rest of the state will be spared. A separate study released last year, led by researchers at University of California at Irvine, looked at the temperatures in the Sierra Nevada range during 450 wildfires that ignited there between 2001 and 2020. The analysis shows that as warming gets worse and temperatures continue to spike, wildfires in Sierra Nevada could increase by 20% or more over the next 20 years. The amount of land burnt would increase even more sharply, rising by 25% by the 2040s. Fires are already exhibiting more extreme behavior, adding new challenges to containment efforts. One new phenomenon documented in a study published recently and led by McDonald's colleagues at the University of California at Los Angeles is blazes are more likely to burn throughout the night. The study found that globally, night fires have grown 7.2% in intensity over the last two decades, thanks to hot, dry conditions that persist after sunset, closing what was once an essential window to tame the flames of wildfire.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Tit for tat measures underway while more Ukrainians are fleeing their country. Ukraine's president says defending the capital Kiev is his top priority, while Russia has promised to demilitarize and denazify Ukraine. Reacting to developments in Ukraine, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says the conflict there is the result of U.S. and Western policies. He cited Ukrainian and former Afghan presidents complaining of Washington leaving them high and dry. Welcome to the Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Let's see who's joining us in this edition of The Spotlight. We'll have senior research fellow with Global Policy Institute George Zamuela joining us out of Budapest. Also with us will be independent international affairs analyst Gilbert Doctorow from Brussels.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Good to see you, gentlemen. Now let me ask George this question. George, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky tweeted a few days ago that his country was left alone by the US and the EU. Why did they betray Zelensky after Russia attacked Ukraine?
Well, just before I attempt to answer that question, I want to congratulate Gilbert. He was on few weeks ago with me, and he predicted that this would happen, and most analysts didn't, he did. Well, to answer your question, though, I think that Zelensky was allowed himself to be used by the United States as a battering ram against Russia. I think, unfortunately, that Ukraine was ill-served by the United States and its allies, and this was the inevitable outcome. There was any number of opportunities as the crisis became more intense, particularly when President Putin started speaking about the Russia's red lines. And it should have been clear to the leaders of the West, Macron, Biden, Blinken, and the Germans, that the Russians were serious. And all Zelensky really had to do was at least to make a show of going ahead and talking. They badly let him down. They didn't explain to him that Russia is very serious. Instead, they allowed Ukraine to posture and to make declarations, open declarations, that we're not even going to legitimize the leaders of the Donetsk and Luhansk republics, even though the Minsk agreement explicitly states that the implementation of it requires negotiations between Kiev and the representatives of the Donetsk and Luhansk. They didn't tell him this. They allowed him to shoot his mouth off in Munich about Ukraine becoming a nuclear power. And, as I say, they let him down very badly, and they let Ukraine down very badly.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Now, Gilbert, there are people who argue that Ukraine has fallen victim to the West policy, especially those of the U.S., and they argue that the crisis in Ukraine and the ensuing Russian war was instigated by Washington and its post-Cold War expansion of NATO toward Russian borders. What's your take? How do you see the West's role in the war in Ukraine?
Well, the United States, the foreign policy community in Washington, must be delighted that they have lured the Russian forces into a war with Ukraine, which Russia did not want. Mm-hmm. Back in December, Russia highlighted to Washington and to NATO its main concern, which was to sit down at the table and talk about changing the architecture of security in Europe, which for the last 25 years the Russians have found very unsatisfactory, discriminatory, and resulting in ever-increasing threats to their national security through the expansion of NATO to the east. So the NATO question was by itself the number one priority of Russia, and Ukraine was to a certain extent an exhibit A about what NATO was about, why NATO was a threat. Exhibit A has become the whole exhibit at the present, because the issue of Russian security has fallen by the wayside, which delights certainly the power elite in Washington. And yet that is not the case in the final analysis. In the final analysis, what is proceeding day by day in the Russian operations in Ukraine is an attempt to smash NATO to pieces. Because the credibility of NATO, the credibility of the United States, and its security umbrella to all of its charges in NATO is being put to the test. And so far, as your question indicated, the test is being failed by the United States. There was stated before the action began, and as a kind of bait to Russia to act, President Biden said that the United States would never send a soldier to fight to help Ukraine in any war with Russia. This was backed up by other NATO members, and it was perfectly clear that Ukraine was being set up for a disaster. But the United States had no interest in the welfare of Ukraine. That Ukraine is simply a tool that was being used to bait, and if they succeeded, to do great damage to Russian sovereignty and Russian national power.
I'm going to ask you a question about that too. Okay, now let me ask George about British Prime Minister Boris Johnson's spokesman saying Monday that Western sanctions in retaliation for the invasion of Ukraine are designed to topple Russian President Vladimir Putin. Is the U.S. seeking regime change in Russia?
Yes, I think that's been a fairly explicit policy on the part of the U.S. They've been dreaming of a return to the Gorbachev-Yeltsin era, and they've been frustrated year after year by Putin. I mean, we know this from the Hillary Clinton the time, you know, that was in 2011, that they were clearly organizing protests in Russia. They want Putin out. The problem, I think, is, and I think this is a serious one, which is that there's a increasingly a mood in the West for some kind of a confrontation with Russia. There doesn't seem to be any of the restraint that used to animate Western governments. I mean, when, you know, Eisenhower in 1956 over Hungary, Lyndon Johnson in 68 over Czechoslovakia, and then subsequently, which is there are certain red lines that you don't cross. And you don't even want to start going on that you're going to get into an armed conflict, because that's just going to escalate into a very dangerous area. And unfortunately, too many Western leaders, such as Boris Johnson, Liz Truss, and others, are talking openly about getting into some kind of a shooting war with Russia. This is so reckless, so absolutely disastrous, because I think the mood in Russia right now is that war, I mean, among the policymakers, that war with the West is inevitable. It may come now, it may come in 2-3 years, but it is coming. And I think that's a...
Gilbert, we also have a group of analysts who believe that the long-term goal of the crisis in Ukraine is to weaken Russia as part of Washington's willingness and crave for a unipolar world. Do you agree with them?
Well, yes, to contain Russia and to keep it down, that is clearly the objective. At the same time, coming back to the sanctions that have been imposed, which really match what was called previously the nuclear option, that is devastating sanctions in the economic sphere. I think that the problem is that in Washington and in Brussels, they really don't understand Russia. They don't have the analytic skills, the intellectual skills, to deal with Russia as it is today. And the economic sanctions are very severe, but I think Russia expects them to be of short duration, because this conflict will end sooner rather than later. The threats to Russian security and the regime or the government in place is not in that area. The issue for Russia is how it conducts this war in Ukraine. And for that reason, the Western press has misunderstood totally what's going on day by day, why it's going so slowly, and so forth. The Russian concern is in the nature of the war as a fratricidal war, as a kind of civil war between two peoples that have a common history and very close relations and great number of intermarriages. Whereas I'm speaking about the Russian and the Ukrainian peoples. Mm-hmm. And for Russia, they have to proceed. The Kremlin has to proceed very carefully in its military operation, not to present mass slaughter in the American way of war, but to do surgical strikes, to destroy military objects, and to destroy those most radical and elements of the fighting forces in Ukraine, namely these battalions like the Azov battalion that is now surrounded in the Mariupol region, and destroy them separately without taking on the ordinary soldiers, all of whom have mothers and girlfriends and perhaps even relatives in Russia, or not to mention without doing significant damage to civilian infrastructure and to civilian people. So the Russian operation is working under constraints that have nothing to do with what Mr. Macron thought he was imposing on Vladimir Putin when they had their telephone call 2 days ago. Russia is proceeding with supreme caution, and the operation is taking longer and is more difficult than the American way of war, which is to march through with shock and awe and kill everything on your path.
And they call it peripheral damage.
Collateral damage of hundreds of thousands of civilians. Yes.
Now, George, Russia's war on Ukraine, many believe, has revealed glaring hypocrisies and racism that Western media and governments are fueling. Let me cite you an example that caused great anger, at least here in West Asia. Maybe you've seen that CBS News senior correspondent, Charlie Diagata. He was reporting from Ukrainian capital Kiev on Friday. He said, I'm quoting him, "This isn't a place, with all due respect, like Iraq or Afghanistan. It has seen conflict raging for decades. This is a relatively civilized, relatively European country." End of quote. So what is said is dehumanization of people of color and race and normalization of white supremacy, plain and simple, is it not?
Well, I think there is something of that. But, you know, you could also say that the dehumanization of Russians and before that, the dehumanization of Serbs was nonetheless played an important role in Western thinking. There is clearly a feeling that the Slavs, such as Russians and such as Serbs, are, you know, you don't want to use the old German expression "Untermenschen," but you know that's more or less what they think. So that's why, when you think of what Russia is doing today. Basically much, much less destructive than what the United States did in Iraq, what the United States did in Afghanistan, what NATO did in Yugoslavia. I mean, we've had 5-6 days, and although the media are trying to whip up hysteria about the horrific civilian casualties, they don't have much to work with. And basically, there hasn't been anything of the scale of those U.S.-led operations that I refer to. So why is everyone so indignant? Well, because it's the Russians. Russians don't have the same rights and prerogatives as we Westerners do. When we do it, that's fine, but when they do it, it isn't. And that's in the same thing goes by with all this a lot of heated talk about violations of international law. Well, the United States has been violating international law left, right, and center, yet never once has anyone tried to impose sanctions on the United States. Never once has the United States been banned from sporting competitions. Mm. Never once has United States oligarchs or very rich people been subjected to sanctions. So there's a very much a different set of standards that apply to the Westerners and to Russians.
Right. Now, on that note, let me ask Gilbert this question. Gilbert, the U.S. and its allies wage unprovoked wars and invasions in several countries: Afghanistan, Iraq, Sudan, Libya, Somalia, Palestine, and Yemen. And this without any U.N. authorization. It killed many people. So are we witnessing a good war, bad war dichotomy here? I mean, how do you explain this hypocrisy?
Well, hypocrisy is the small change of diplomacy everywhere in the world. It has been and it will be. So I wouldn't be in a state of shock over the double standards. That's to be expected. And I don't think that in the Kremlin they are suffering too much from any of the sanctions. You'll notice that the Russians have not responded to these sanctions, other than the banning of airspace, right, where they responded at once, but to the nuclear option, attacks on the Central Bank of Russia and so forth. They have so far done nothing. And that tells you that they don't believe that these sanctions will long endure, and that they have in reserve compensatory sanctions that they are ready to impose if necessary. But there are no rush to do that. Now, what am I talking about? We all know that the BP has said it's going to divest its shares in Rosneft, which are about 20% of Rosneft and are worth at least $25 billion. They will take a beating on that, take a terrible loss, because it's hard to think who exactly, other than the Chinese, are going to stand up and present them with a check to buy their shares. That is the least of it. In the Russians, if they want to respond in like, can confiscate all of European property in Russia, which far exceeds in value whatever is being frozen in Russian assets in the West. But the Russians haven't been in haste to use those countermeasures, because they don't believe that this hysteria that we see today will last beyond a couple of weeks, during which time the problems will be resolved, including the whole question of Europe giving a fast-track admittance to Ukraine. Fast-track normally would mean 18 months. Ukraine, as it presently looks, will be lucky to stay in one piece beyond 2 or 3 weeks, after which it will probably be divided, reluctantly divided, by Russia, in collaboration with local people who are willing to work in and lead the new states.
Yeah. George, did you hear Gilbert's prediction? We'll wait for another 2-3 weeks and see if that comes true, too. Okay, that was my last question, of course, but you just mentioned it now. Now, George, let's talk a little bit about the way European countries have been welcoming Ukrainians and fleeing the war in their country with open arms, which is, of course, a good thing. But they did not treat refugees from Middle East and Africa in, let's say, 2021. They were fleeing wars in their countries, and those wars were caused by the U.S. and NATO. They were responsible for that. Can you shed some light on this?
Well, I think it goes back to your earlier point about hypocrisy. And if you remember, a couple of months ago, we had another bout of hysteria about this was involved Poland and Belarus. And the Poles were absolutely beside themselves over the prospect of 3,000 refugees or migrants or whatever you will, coming across the border from Belarus, and the EU was indignant about it, and NATO, and everybody condemned Belarus, and of course by implication Russia, that these people were on the border, and in fact Poland unleashed a cold water hose. This was late November, so that's pretty nasty. And again, you know, everyone just blamed Belarus and Russia. So yes, there's very much double standards, and it's you know, even applies to Viktor Orban, you know, who's been the great champion in Europe of saying no to migrants. He apparently is welcoming migrants from Ukraine, and so that, you know, that might cause him some political problems. But yeah, I mean, I think that the Europeans are doing an awful lot of posturing, you know, this obviously with the migrants, but with a lot of very heated bluster in regard to what they're going to do with the Russians. We're going to take on Putin in Ukraine. Well, the Europeans haven't heard a shot fired in anger, you know, for decades, for 75 years. So therefore, the only power capable of fighting Russia is the United States. So it's basically, if they're not going to do any fighting, it's going to have to be the United States. And so far, the U.S. is you know, trying to tamp down this war fever, saying, no, we're not going to be setting up no-fly zones. No, we're not going to get directly involved. So I think the Europeans are behaving in absolutely ridiculous fashion.
Okay. Now, Gilbert, we have only 30 seconds if you want to add to your comments, especially your prediction.
Well, it's very difficult to be wise. The situation on the ground changes. I believe that Mr. Putin and his immediate advisors are extremely flexible and have been revising, will continue to revise, both strategy and tactics, depending on what they see on the ground. And so for us on the sidelines, as commentators, it is extremely difficult to predict with any degree of reliability what will happen 2 or 3 weeks from now. But there are just some indications, as I said, that a likely split up of the Ukraine, supervised by the Russians, is in the cards. Whether that happens will depend on the rulers in Kiev presently and how they react to the Russian advances.
Okay, and that note, we come to the end of this show. Let me thank our guests. We had Senior Research Fellow with Global Policy Institute, George Zamweli in Budapest, and Independent International Affairs Analyst, Gilbert Doctor in Brussels. Thank you. I've been your host, Behrouz Najafi, and I'll see you next time.